Welcome to another episode of the House of Wisdom podcast, where we interview academic influencers about their research and how it can shape the world. I'm Deepak Mawar, an academic.
And I'm Carl Lewis, also an academic.
Fantastic. I've realized now that this very annoying thing that I often respond to people going, brilliant. And I need to stop doing this.
I do the same. I say I use either absolutely or definitely.
Okay.
I don't know why.
It's one of those annoying things that once you start a podcast, you realize, oh, there's these weird tics I've got.
Yeah.
And I need to stop that. And also, sometimes I say it and it doesn't make sense why I'm saying brilliant. I'm just responding. Yeah. And because of silence, I've just said brilliant. So I'm holding back on that.
It's the awkwardness of silence. I also think most people don't like listening to their own voice.
Yeah.
And yet we necessarily have to do this to listen to our episodes. So we're our own worst nightmare in terms of critics, right? Yeah. God, it's awful. I hate it so much. The doing it is fine, but then hearing yourself.
Yeah. Again and again. with the editing process. He's like, this guy needs to stop talking. Wait, that's me.
Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. So a very quick thing. Apologies for the slight delay that we've had with the episodes. We've had a few things that have kept us occupied. Some of our guests got a little bit busy with things, also got ill, so we did have to kind of just delay the episodes a little bit. So really do apologize for that. We will try going forward to not have that happen and try to be consistent as possible, because I think that is the magic of being a successful podcast, is being consistent. So we will try to do that. But yes, do forgive us. It wasn't something that we intended to do, but it was just things got a little bit tricky and busy for not only us, but also for our guests. This week's episode is on the European Court of Human Rights and why it matters and why it's important for us. I was listening to things going on in UK politics recently, and I was just feeling the need to talk about this. So that's why we've got an amazing guest to discuss this topic. And yeah, we can't wait to get involved, right? We can't wait to deep dive into this subject and why the European Court of Human Rights matters.
Absolutely. I think there it goes. I did it just then. I said, absolutely. but this time I actually meant it. We can't wait to get stuck in. This is a topic that I think is close to both of our hearts. I think because we both spent time in the UK, we're both from the UK, comments which have come lately from UK politics suggesting that the UK leave the European Convention on Human Rights shocked us. And of course, it hit us also a little bit personally. So we've been talking about finding someone to explain the ECHR, the European Court of Human Rights system, from an expert perspective, and yeah, we're very happy that we have someone to do that today.
A quick few clarifications. So we mentioned the HRA, which is the Human Rights Act. That is basically UK legislation that has incorporated the European Convention of Human Rights within its domestic legal system. What else do we mention? Okay, very important to mention that there is a distinction between the EU and the ECHR. They are separate bodies. The ECHR is very much specifically focusing on human rights aspects and human rights topics, whereas the EU is the organization that we've all come to know very well in the last 5 or 6 years as a result of many discussions that we've been, at least in the UK anyway. Obviously, beyond that, we do know, but obviously it's become a hot topic within the UK. So yeah, those are some of the distinctions that we wanted to clarify before we deep dive into the episode. Okay, let's jump into the episode.
And you want to come out of the European Convention on Human Rights. Why do you want to do it?
Well, I've seen throughout my experience, I was a barrister specialising in immigration law, defending the Home Office before I was an MP, and as Attorney General, I've seen firsthand that we can't fix the problem of illegal migration because of human rights claims and because of an interventionist, politicised foreign court in Strasbourg, which is intervening to thwart our domestic policies, as we saw last month on the Rwanda flight. And I'm afraid the only solution to this problem, and if we want to be honest with the British people on delivering on Brexit, on taking back control over our borders, is that we do now need to leave the European Convention of Human Rights. I've pledged that, and I challenge all my fellow candidates to make that similar pledge. None of them have.
That was the current Home Office Secretary of the UK, Suella Braverman, discussing the European Court of Human Rights, claiming that it is a foreign, interventionist, politicised court that is not allowing the UK to deal with illegal migration because of human rights.
But is the court really interventionist and politicised, or is it ensuring that countries such as the UK respect obligations they had made to the European Convention of Human Rights? Moreover, is the rhetoric that human rights is a problem an indication of a sort of politics that is troubling and dangerous? In this episode, we talk to Dr. Rumyana Van Ark, a researcher in counterterrorism and human rights at the Asser Institute of the University of Amsterdam. She provides her expertise on the subject to explore how instrumental the Conservative Party was in the formation of the European Court of Human Rights and the Convention, the problem with how the media often portrays the impact of the court, and the important social, political, and legal impact the court has made in making the lives of countless individuals so much better when they sought out justice.
Welcome, Dr. Van Ark. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me on.
So I think the first question we want to ask was, just tell us a little bit about yourself in terms of how you got interested in this kind of research, your academic path. I think it's always great for the listeners to know a little bit about the people that we are interviewing.
Well, a lot of my interest is really linked to where I come from. I come from former USSR satellite country, Bulgaria, and I was one of the first school generations that never had to study Russian as mandatory in school, but also one of the first generations that from a very young age, you started overhearing things. We want to be part of the European Union, or you want to be like everyone on the other side of the Iron Curtain. You started hearing phrases like, we also want to have human rights. So I thought a lot about it as a child in the way that you do, what is this and how can I learn more about it? And then in secondary school, we had this great history teacher who taught us history beyond what was in the history books, including one of the most, I think, special, weird, unique moments in Bulgarian history in the immediate aftermath of World War II, when Bulgaria had actually been an ally for a year. When the Russian tanks came to Sofia and the Communist Party took over leadership of the country, a number, a very, very substantial number, but unconfirmed number of people disappeared. And they tended to be the usual suspects in many respects. They tended to be mayors. They tended to be senior civil servants. They tended to be academics. They tended to be lawyers and many, many other similar highly or well-educated individuals or leaders in local communities, businesses, etc. The families never heard where they went, what happened. And a couple of years later, to justify their disappearance and very likely their death, there were trials held to actually pass a sentence on these individuals, even though the likelihood was that they had already died a long time ago in very difficult circumstances. And that is unique, to actually hold a trial for individuals that have died or likely have died. And that sparked my interest in terms of humanity and dignity and what we do to each other. And this is how I ended up being really interested in the convention, how it works, the thinking of the judges behind the cases, why do they reach certain decisions, how do they see the concepts of dignity and rights, and how do they approach individuals in particular circumstances. And I should say it's by no means perfect. The convention is not perfect. The operation of the court is not perfect. You cannot be happy with every judgment that is passed there, especially against certain countries. You want the much more idealistic, harsh finding a violation on everything. But that's not the point. The point is that for me, coming from a country where human life was very deep, to put it in that way, that it was very easy to lose without any sanction on the state for very extended periods of time. Not being a member of the convention and not being part of the convention is a lot worse than actually being part of the convention, even if it's not perfect. And you only know what you lose and how damaging this is to individuals when you're on the outside. When you're in the inside, you see the flaws. On the outside, you see the benefits.
I always find it amazing to hear the backstory that inspires or influences someone to then go down a path. I think it clarifies everything. It makes everything so much more clearer in terms of the picture. So it's really interesting to hear like just the formative years and how important they are to actually leading down the track that you've ended down. So on that basis, I think it's a perfect time to then talk about someone who's probably on the opposite end of the spectrum as you, where someone that, you know, does think the European Court of Human Rights, European Convention of Human Rights is an important instrument, it's an important legal system in place, to Suella Braverman, who was really the person that actually sparked our need or our interest to actually discuss this this topic. She's currently the Home Secretary of the UK, and we just listened to a clip of her talking about the European Court of Human Rights being a interventionist court and human rights being a barrier to them being able to deport people to Rwanda or asylum seekers to Rwanda. So I think it'd be great for us to hear about the historical narrative of the European Convention of Human Rights and the European Court of Human Rights, and how we started off in a very different place and to then how we've got to where we are now, where we're talking about the court being this evil.
Well, that's an excellent question. Very challenging, but excellent question. I'd like to start slightly with the very general history first. Just I feel it's very important to note that the very first international document to take steps towards the recognition of human rights was actually the UN Charter of 1945, and specifically Articles 55 and 56. And you don't hear a lot of criticism by states on the UN Charter per se, quite the contrary, when they need to rely on other parts of the Charter. But what the Charter started then became, in 1948, the basis for the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which provided the first extensive catalogue of what human rights are, what fundamental freedoms are. And what the European Convention of Human Rights does at its core is to draw its inspiration from the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. But they're not duplicates. And they're not duplicates of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights precisely because of the involvement of states such as the United Kingdom and others following World War II onto the convention itself. Well, I'll start by saying that what the convention is probably the most successful attempt to implement the Universal Declaration of Human Rights through binding court decisions, decisions which the contracting parties undertake to abide rather than through recommendations or reports or information or lamentations as some of the other regional frameworks have. And this is part of the issue for Suella Braverman, and we'll come back to that. So where in contrast, the UN regime and UN-based human rights law is really soft, non-binding, more political than actually heavy legislation, the effects of the ECHR implemented through the courts go quite beyond this. And this is part of the concern. It is the only regional document that is binding on practically a whole continent. And I think the biggest challenge, and it has been a challenge from the very, very beginnings of the convention through the initial negotiations even, that the ECHR has never regarded these rights as static. The convention has always been, the intention has always been to see the convention as a living instrument. Why? For the very simple reason, in my view, that as society changes, as our approach to cultural and other events changes, these rights, they need to be able to breathe. They need to be able to reflect where we are as a community, where we are as a society, where we are as a continent. And this was all part of the initial discussions and negotiations that the UK was very involved in. But at the same time, it is, I think, a very politically unpalatable statement to say this is a living document. So we have to continue complying to it in a different way. As times changes, it's much easier to criticize it. The history of the convention is so strongly interlinked with the history of the Conservative Party that it deserves a mention. And it deserves this mention because it's very rare these days that the two are actually put together in the same sentence or in the same article for that reason. So I just wanted to walk you through some key moments. In May of 48, none other than Sir Winston Churchill presided over a Congress that had gathered in The Hague for an intensive, very high-level study of the political and economic problems of a proposed European Union. I don't think we need to go into detail of who Winston Churchill is, both for the UK and for the Conservative Party. More than 700 delegates attended the gathering that has since been associated as the core of the formation of the European movement. It was an independent body, but it also included a range of academics, of former prime ministers and foreign ministers, of ministers currently in office, as well as leading figures across Europe, such as Horst Lauterbach. And just over a year later, in July 49, the European movement produced a 32-page publication simply entitled European Convention on Human Rights. And it contained the draft convention, a draft statute for a proposed European Court of Human Rights, as well as explanatory notes under the heading of Examination of Criticisms. There were three leading figures behind the draft. One was Fernand Dehaus, who was a Belgian jurist. Another was Pierre-Henri Degen, a resistance hero and later minister of justice in post-occupation France. And the third one was Sir David Maxwell Fyfe. And I just want to focus on him for a moment. Sir David Maxwell Fyfe, aside from being one of the prosecuting counsels in the Nuremberg trials, also happened to be a member of the Conservative Party, who had held the offices of Solicitor General, Attorney General, Home Secretary, and Lord High Chancellor of Great Britain. And most of these positions were actually held within Winston Churchill-led governments. And he, Sir David Maxwell Fyfe, was perhaps one of the leading proponents of the so-called alarm bell idea around the convention, i.e. that it was really necessary to create a conscience in Europe, a conscience that will sound the alarm. And as such, it was a conscience that belonged to Europe itself, and a conscience that to be operationalized, you needed a court with the convention. And the comments of Suella Braverman, in many respects, they're not new, because at the time and from the very outset in these discussions and negotiations and drafting processes, more sovereignty-conscious states, sovereignty, including and in particular the UK, were very hostile to the creation of a binding convention. So they didn't actually want to do something very different in comparison to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, a declaration being non-binding, convention being binding. And at the same time, the UK exercised huge influence throughout the process, was very persistent on the fact, for example, that the rights within this European Convention on Human Rights need to be precisely defined. And at the same time, they worked very hard to ensure that the way these rights were drafted was in conformity with what already existed in English common law in terms of rights. And again, this is part of the history development processes around the drafting of the convention that rarely gets a public discussion now. And it really needs to, because the UK was critical to both moving forward in convincing other European states to create this conscience of Europe, critical in the language and the phrasing, and at the same time, very, very strategic in ensuring that these rights actually were symmetrical and worked in conformity with existing English common law rights. So in some respects, you can actually say that the European Convention of Human Rights is very much at its core an English document or a British document. And despite strong opposition to the convention domestically, the UK was actually the first state to deposit its instrument of ratification in Rome in March of 1951.
So if I could ask a question then, so we've talked a lot now about, you've taught us quite a bit now already about sovereignty, the role of the UK in history. And so Deepak rightly said that we were inspired to discuss this topic because of Suella Braverman's comments on leaving DCHR, but we all are relatively equipped with some knowledge of law, right? So we understand these terms, sovereignty, the convention, the United Nations Charter. For the average person who heard these comments from Suella, and I don't want to just point her out, but he hears these comments from those claiming that the UK would be better off if it leaves the European Convention on Human Rights. Could you explain to us really quickly, in simple terms, what does it do? Why is it that the Conservative Party was critical, right, in trying to push for this recognition of this regional understanding of rights being defended, right? Why is it that the UK wanted the ECHR? As and then the Human Rights Act, of course, to be part of its conscience as well, along with the European conscience around it. So for the average person.
Thanks. Great question. And again, history is absolutely critical here. And we have to really think of the context of when the convention was born and on the ashes of what it was actually born. And if I can use the words of Lucius Waldhaber, one of the first president of the European Court of Human Rights after the adoption of Protocol 11, which changed the operation of the court. The ECHR is a product of realistic idealism. It was a direct reaction to the atrocities of the 1930s and 1940s. It was anchored in a belief that democratic regimes respectful of human rights do not go to war with one another. And therefore, there can no longer be an issue of purely democratic jurisdiction of when democracies relapse into dictatorships. to put it in a different way, there was two core concerns which drove the Council of Europe while drafting the convention. One, provide a means for individuals through which the most serious human rights violations that had occurred during World War II could be avoided in the future. And this is really important. This is the final port of call for an individual to bring their country of nationality or another country that is a member to the convention to task if they have committed serious human rights violations. And that's one. The other core concern, again, huge importance of historical context to protect the state parties to the convention from communist subversion, with that particular battle between Soviet and non-Soviet states being at the forefront for a number of decades. And this second concern, to protect states from communist subversion, partly explains for me the recurrent references within the introductory remarks in the convention, within the discussions and negotiations of values and principles necessary in a democratic society.
So one of the reasons that we were so keen to have this podcast was actually to give the opportunity for experts to actually discuss these topics, discuss these issues and agendas, because at times I think the media depiction of the, or the media narrative of it, can lead to a very skewed perspective on it. And I think in particular with the ECHR, that relationship with the media has been something that's been a little bit tricky and a little bit difficult. So I kind of just want to ask you, in terms of like, what is that relationship with the media, and why is it perhaps in certain situations a little bit problematic?
Another excellent and very challenging question. And if I may start with some statistics, because I think statistics are important in providing a context for some of the next questions perhaps you're going to ask me. In 2021, the total number of judgments involving the UK were 7. Yeah, single digit, 7. In 2 of those, there was no violation. In 5 of those cases, there was a violation. More often than not, it was a procedural rather than a substantive one, i.e. there was a lack of appropriate investigation or similar. In contrast, there were 232 judgments involving Russia, in which there were 219 violations. So when we talk about cases involving the UK, in general, as the statistics out, not just for 2021, but beyond, all the way back to 1959, bear out, the number of cases and the number of judgments against the UK is one of the lowest in comparison to other state parties. The UK doesn't even feature in the top 10 in terms of statistically individually identifiable countries. The UK is only in the category, always in the category of other. And we are talking in terms of percentage of cases of the grand total that the court has to deal with every year, very small single digits, under 2%. So when the media tends to have conversations in respect of cases the UK is involved in, this part of the statistics never really comes out to the fore, that we're talking about a very, very, very small percentage of cases that there is a violation in respect of a country that in principle, there's very, very few number of cases that make it to the admissible stages and that are heard by a grand chamber or chamber before of the courts. And that's, I think that's really important to clarify. Second point, which I find very problematic and that unfortunately never gets a lot of explanation, but also is linked to the question that Kyle asked before. This is a court of last resort. This is a court that you can access only after you have exhausted all domestic remedies. And this is an absolute core fundamental principle of the ECHR. And I mention this because this exhaustion of domestic remedies is directly interlinked with what is one of the core other principles of the court and the convention, subsidiarity. In other words, the court is always intended to be secondary to the national legal machinery. It is never the intention to interfere in domestic matters. It is never the intention to force a change in legislation. What it really does is clarifies standards. It clarifies the interpretation of rights. It holds states to account on the interpretation of rights. It does not say in simple terms, you need to change your legislation now. In fact, it gives a lot of leeway to states as to how they might consider changing domestically their legislation if it's deemed necessary. And yes, it does sometimes develop those standards beyond the literal or the original conception to reflect these more contemporary standards, as I mentioned earlier on, or they do try to suggest that perhaps there's a more appropriate level of limitation on state action, but how the decisions are implemented is for the state itself to decide. And this is crucial. And this never tends to be part of the public discussions. And it's hugely problematic because if you skip these steps of the statistics, which provide an objective picture or relatively objective picture, and if you skip the step of explaining what the ECHR is meant to do, and that it is meant to be secondary to national legal machinery and its interpretation and in many respects guidance to domestic legal machinery, well, then that creates huge amount of space for misinterpretation, misrepresentation, and ultimately misunderstanding. And unfortunately, more often than not, the decisions of the court do tend to be misrepresented when they are printed in media. What is picked on is perhaps more incendiary comments as part of the court's deliberation, not necessarily the actual findings or decisions. And this happens, unsurprisingly for me, a lot when it comes to do to the big three, as I put it, that overlap in terms of both really important for public debate for politicians, but also really important in the context of legal interpretation, national security, immigration, and violation of core rights of states to individuals. So, for example, inhuman and degrading treatment, deportation that can't occur due to inhuman and degrading treatment in another country, etc. They can trigger a lot of headlines. And unfortunately, more often than not, the actual finding of the court are not represented or printed with sufficient clarity, precision, and it creates a certain narrative that you can slot in later on.
This is, of course, super interesting. I think you're right to point out that how the court is represented, so the European Court of Human Rights is represented, matters. I want to now, let's say, draw what is your wealth of knowledge on specific cases, right? Because you talked to us before when we were talking about doing this podcast about specific cases that show the importance of the ECHR, that show the importance of the system.
So there's two cases that I want to highlight. Dudgeon versus the UK from 1981 and Norris versus Ireland in 1988. Mr. Dudgeon's complaints in his case were directed primarily against the existence in Northern Ireland of laws which had the effect of making homosexuality and certain homosexual acts between consenting adults criminal offences. Specifically under Section 61 and 62 of the 1861 Criminal Offences Act, made offences punishable with a maximum sentence of life imprisonment or 10 years of imprisonment respectively, which is quite harsh. But also, I think when we look at it from today's perspective, it seems unconscionable and it's difficult to understand. But yet it was part of legislation impacting on day-to-day life of numerous individuals across the UK. In his own words, Mr. Dudgeon had known that he was gay since the age of 14. And for some time, he had been conducting a campaign in his own time aimed at bringing the law in Northern Ireland into line with that in force in England and Wales, but also achieving a minimum age of consent under the age of 21. And ultimately what the ECTHR found was that the maintenance of this and continued operation of this particular legislation constitutes a continuous, persistent interference with his right to respect his right to private life within the meaning of Article 8 of the Convention. And in his personal circumstances, the very existence of this legislation continuously and directly affected his private life every single day and had been affecting his private life every single day. So you mentioned how important it is for individuals to know that they have access to this convention and have access to the court. Well, here is one example. Example from a case in 1981, where if we look at it from our perspective now, we struggle to understand how is this possible? Why was this possible? Why was there legislation such as this in place? And the Norris case versus Ireland is similar in that sense. David Norris was both a politician in Ireland, well-known campaigner for gay rights since the 1970s. In 1974, he became a founder and chairman of Irish Gay Rights and the Irish Gay Rights Movement. And his complaints were also directed against the existence in Ireland of laws which made it criminal for certain gay practices between consenting adults. It made it a criminal offence. He gave very compelling evidence in the domestic courts of the impact this legislation had on his day-to-day life, that he suffered deep depression and loneliness on realizing that he was gay, but at the same time that any expression of his sexuality would inevitably result in criminal prosecution. And this led to his campaigning. If we talk about personal histories and the issues that matter that bring you to be involved with the convention, he had not been charged either before or at the time of the court proceedings with any offence in relation to what was already publicly known about his personal life and personal activities, but he remained at risk of being so prosecuted under domestic criminal legislation, either by the director of public prosecutions or private prosecution initiated by someone. So similar to the Dudgeon case, the court found that there was a daily, continuous, persistent, challenging interference with his life. And as a result of this, he either has to respect the law as it is and refrain from engaging even in private and even with consenting partners in prohibited activity, or he commits a criminal offence and has to face a criminal prosecution. So they reached the same conclusion as the Dudgeon case, which then led to significant changes in the Criminal Offences Act in Ireland, same as in the UK. And again, one person, an individual, and I will keep reiterating this, it is about an individual having access to this body to interpret their rights and the access to the rights that they should have in mind with changes in society. And it's important because as individuals, we don't often know the remit or extent of our rights, and we can forget just how powerful the machinery of states can be against an individual or group of individuals. As I've said at the start, the convention is not perfect. The court is not perfect. But these are cases where the court itself has said to a state, no, what it is there domestically needs to be interpreted differently because you're interfering with the individual's right, not just the particular individuals in these particular cases, numerous other individuals who perhaps don't have the bravery and the strength to bring these cases or know that they have access to bring a case to us eventually the last point of resource, and yet they're suffering every single day.
So as we start to wrap up this interview, we always talk about the House of Wisdom. We always imagine, myself and Carl always imagine that, well, might be a real thing somewhere. So if you were to develop some sort of speech or advocate towards Suella Braverman to maybe rethink her position, who would be the person that you would have beside you in the House of Wisdom to draft this and to figure out how to exactly convince Suella Braverman? Maybe, you know, withdrawing from the ECHR is not necessarily the best thing to do.
If I may, I would very much have at least one, if not two, if not more, of the family members who lost a sibling, a parent, a friend, a neighbor in the Hillsborough disaster, because there are indirect links between the convention and the Human Rights Act in the UK. And we can talk a little bit more about that if you were to ask me to. But the reason I mention that is, if I can quote Becky Shah, who lost her mum in the Hillsborough disaster, had it not been for the Human Rights Act, we wouldn't have gotten the verdict that we did in the last inquest. It's one of the most significant pieces of legislation that governs rights for UK citizens. The convention has had a huge impact on individual lives. It has had a huge impact in recognizing individuals as having dignity, as being worthy of empathy and sympathy, but it's for everyone. There may be some unsympathetic applicants, ones who may have engaged in serious criminality or terrorist activities. And it's very easy to take a brush and paint them as undeserving recipients of rights protections. But if you start making choices of who is deserving of rights protection, then you don't have a convention anymore, you don't have a Human Rights Act anymore, and you don't even have UK common law rights anymore. They intend to apply to everyone.
So, Dr. Van Ock, thank you very much for your time. It's been an amazing interview, and we're more than happy to have you over again in the House of Wisdom.
Well, thank you. You're very kind.
Indeed. I feel like, I could have listened to you talk about the system, the convention, its importance, and case law. Yeah, for the rest of the day. Thank you so much, Dr. Van Ock.
Well, thank you. You're incredibly kind.
So that was the episode with Dr. Romiana Van Ock. So the most important thing I would say is I love listening to Romiana speak and talk about the CHR. She's such a wealth of knowledge and so engaging and so passionate, which is something I really, really appreciated and enjoyed from hearing her talk about this topic. So yeah, absolutely incredible researcher. And yeah, she had so many examples that we couldn't actually fit in, and yeah, and so many cases where the European Court of Human Rights had made such an important impact. And yeah, we just didn't have the time to talk about it, did we?
No, exactly. I think that's important to say. I think Romiana could have gone on with many examples of case law to reinforce points that would be made in this podcast. But unfortunately, we have to finish after about half an hour or so. But we're going to be adding links to this podcast, where so those of you who are interested and want to read more or read case law or hear more about certain things, you can click on those links and read up some more.
There was one incident that I really did want to, or one case study that I really did want to make reference of, that Romiana mentioned right at the end. So when we were talking about who she would bring with her to the House of Wisdom if she was to create some piece of advocacy or some sort of speech to deliver to Suella Braverman, she talks about those family members of those people that lost their lives during the Hillsborough incident, which was a really, really awful point in modern UK history or modern English history. It's really important to mention the impact of the European Convention of Human Rights on this incident and on this case, in terms of the Human Rights Act incorporating the European Convention and allowing the proper processes and procedures to take place. So making sure that the correct investigation took place was a key centerpiece of making sure that those people that lost their lives, the 96 members, did find justice. So yeah, it just shows some of the most important moments in modern English history, modern European history, the importance of the European Convention and, to, in other cases, the European Court of Human Rights has played in making sure the correct decision is being made.
Absolutely. I think for those who maybe are listening and don't know about the Hillsborough incident, again, we'll add some links to this so you can read up about this moment in, like Deepak said, modern UK history, and see what effect the European Convention has had on the investigations that were then taking place.
Yeah. And so the final thing that we probably want to mention is Suella Braverman herself and some of the comments, and bringing it full circle, because that's kind of the inspiration for this episode. And just to kind of directly respond to what she did say in that little excerpt in that interview, in terms of, is the court interventionist, is it politicized? Certainly, you can argue, yes, the court is interventionist and to a certain degree, maybe a little bit politicized. However, the direction that the court is taking and the convention is taking is one towards making sure that individuals, their rights are protected much better, they're safeguarded, and there is not that intrusion, there is not that violation of their rights, and human rights is better regulated and better safeguarded within the region.
Exactly. I think in the clip that we include at the beginning of this episode, the way that this phrasing is being employed there by Suella, this idea of it being interventionist, the fact it almost sounds as if the court is imposing, right? Whereas, as Romiana was telling us throughout this episode, is, well, no, it's very much a court of last resort. It protects individuals. And of course, it is the UK which has asked it to do so, right? And for good reason. We want to have a resort to make sure that human rights are protected, even after all resources at the state level have been used up. And it's important. And that's why it's so important, right? So it was unfortunate phrasing there by Suella Braverman, because it really does make it sound as if it's a court acting above the UK in some sort of, I don't know, aggressive way, which is certainly not the case, right?
Yeah, I think it's really important to remember it is reminding states of their obligations to conventions that they previously signed and making sure that the legislation that they create is in accordance with those obligations. So it's not, as we talked about, and Carl, you made that very clear, it's not this court that's hanging over countries, but actually working side by side, being that supplementary, that complementary court to actually the domestic legal systems.
Well said. The side by side point is really well said. And I think you also said, you know, in this clip, she mentions Brexit. It's got nothing to do with Brexit. Again, the convention, the court have nothing to do with the European Union in that direct institutional sense, right? So that's another, let's say, misunderstanding that we need to make sure we are clear about, right? Because we don't want to confuse institutions, and we definitely don't want to tag the European court with all of the other negative rhetoric which has come alongside with Brexit, right?
Absolutely. Brexit is about the European Union being part of the European Union. The European Court of Human Rights is a whole different thing in itself. Yes, so easy on face value to maybe confuse the two and see them as the same entity. Yeah, there is a relationship between the two organisations, but they are still separate. So it's really important to remind that. Yeah, this debate was a little bit problematic. It did make me worry about the direction that the UK is taking, for sure. Okay, so I think that was a really, really good episode. Really enjoyed that. Looking forward to what's coming next. We've got loads of things in store for you for Christmas and the new year. So keep your eyes peeled. Please listen to us on the various podcast platforms. Follow us on Twitter. As we say, our Twitter handle is Pod of Wisdom. And so I think that covers everything. Carl, can you wrap the episode off, please?
Sure. Thank you so much for listening. As always, we look forward to seeing you once again in our next episode of the House of Wisdom podcast.